On this episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast, we talk with photographer Stephen Whitsett, based in North Carolina.
The whole thing is all integrated. It's all, you can't say, well, this is my creative life over here, and this is my personal. It's, to me, there's no separation between all of it.
Ready to do this thing?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
Hi, my name is Mark Mosry.
And I'm Chris Hollow, and this is episode number 9 of Creativity in Motion, a podcast about creativity where we talk with creatives of all kinds to find out why they create and especially how they overcome creative obstacles.
In this episode, we'll be talking with photographer Steve Whitsett about his 30-year professional photography career and how he has managed, like anyone who's had a career for over 30 years, to keep that going and the creative steps he's taken to keep his career fresh and his work relevant.
Before we get into it, we'd like to tell you about our sponsor, Nosy College of Art. Nosy College opened in 1973 as a fine art school and is transformed into Tennessee's only private art college. They offer bachelor's degree programs in commercial illustration, graphic design, video and film, and photography. And starting in September 2021, they'll be offering a brand new culinary arts associate's degree. They have a beautiful 55,000 square foot facility that was built with the artistic student in mind that includes computer labs, production suites, photography and video studios, and a fully stocked equipment cage. Everything students need to get creative. To learn more about Nosy College of Art, you can visit nosy.edu for degree program details, faculty information, and student work.
Today, we are super happy to be joined by photographer Steve Whitsett. Steve has been a professional photographer since 1989, which means he's been a full-time creative for over 30 years. In that time span, he's worked with some of the most famous names in music and entertainment. Steve, it feels like it's been a long time coming, but it's so great to have you with us today.
Thanks so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Just right at the top, if you don't mind, just talking a little bit about how you got started in photography and take us through those first few years up to the point where you were able to kind of go out and say, okay, I'm a professional photographer right now.
Well, I picked up a camera when I was in the military. I spent 5 years in Uncle Sam's Canoe Club, also known as the United States Navy. And I needed to find something else to do besides spend all of my free time drinking. And so I got a camera and just found out that I really enjoyed it. And by the time I finished with my 5 years, I was, you know, I was officially an amateur photographer. I just liked taking pictures. I had taken one photo class in junior college when I was in like my last year in the Navy. And then when I got out, before I got out, I had noticed that a lot of people that got out of the military before me, I'd kind of kept track of them and they had great plans. They were going to go and do this and go and do that. And it just seemed like that a lot of them didn't follow through. And so when I was getting ready to get out, I thought I deserve something for surviving this, because essentially being like, even though I didn't really realize that I was a creative person, I always had kind of a creative mind, and which made me question everything. And so when you have that and when you question everything and you're in the military where they want sort of blind obedience, I bumped into a lot of brick walls. Right. And so for surviving that, I thought I deserve something. And the best part of the military for me was travel. And so just before I got out a globe and I spun it around and I thought, of all the places that I could go, what's the place that intimidates me the most? And by far, it was the continent of Africa. So on the day that I got discharged, I took all of my getting out money and I went and bought a round trip ticket for Nairobi, Kenya, and went there sort of with two intentions. One, to, you know, to take photos, and two, to sort of figure out in a vision quest kind of a way how I wanted the rest of my life to play out. Not necessarily what I wanted to do, but but sort of what kind of lifestyle I wanted to have. So while I was in Africa, I climbed Kilimanjaro and I went on safari and I spent a little bit of time thinking and I thought, well, I want to have a job where someone calls me on the phone and says, Steve, we want you to go to blank to do blank. And by far the thing that seemed to make most sense was photography. And, you know, flash forward a few years later, I have been paid to travel literally all over the world to do photography. And so, you know, that was a really great vision quest that I had. When I returned, actually, I want to back up a little bit. When I was in high school, when I was in school, I was never somebody who thought that I was smart enough to go to college. I just didn't like going to school in the 60s and 70s. There were the kids that were college bound. And then there was the kids like me who I just thought I was going to have a trade and that was it. But while I was in the Navy, I sort of looked at my peers and I was like, God, maybe I'm smart enough to go to college after all. So I came back and the one photography class that I had taken, the guy was a graduate of Brooks Institute of Photography. And I talked to him and he's like, yeah, go. And so I applied and got accepted and went. And for me, it was really important just for my self-esteem to get a formal education. And you know, I learned later on that actually I learned a lot more assisting than I did when I was in school. But I think that school gave me the structure to be able to learn. And it gave me the discipline to do things that I would have never given myself as self-assignments. So, you know, so going to school was really important for me. And that was where actually I met you, Mark.
Right. I still remember the day I met you at Bill's studio.
Actually, I think we met at school because you came up to me at school and said, I'm going to be working at Bill's studio. And I should really tell this, if you want to edit out, you can, but my first impression of you was that there's no way possible that somebody could be this nice. And in over 30 years of knowing you, it amazes me that you're one of the single nicest human beings I've ever met in my life. So.
Wow. You're blowing the minds of many people right now, especially many former students of mine who just think you're a straight up liar right now. Well,
they just need to put in 30 years of knowing you.
did you find going to school at Brooks, did you find any similarity to that and sort of the formal way of doing things? Because that's how Brooks Institute of Photography worked. There was the Brooks way. And then there were other ways if you wanted to kind of probably get it wrong, right? If you wanted to get it right all the time, every time, you do it this way. Just thinking about your time in the military where people expected you to be blindly obedient, there was a little bit of that at Brooks. You know, it's like, hey, we're going to strip you down whatever habits you have with your photography that you've learned on your own. We're going to teach you how to go into the darkroom, how to do it correctly, how to process film correctly, how to use the equipment, and we want you to start thinking like this.
There was a question in there somewhere.
So, yeah, I think it's interesting that the formality of school after being in the Navy for 5 years was still attractive to you, like being told how to do it.
Well, I think that what it was, though, was at the same time that I was going to school, I was assisting for Bill, and while his technique was always extraordinary, he just really, really was unbelievable in the technique of his lighting and all that. But I also could see how he utilized that to be very creative. And so it was just a nice balance. And when I, you know, once I got out and started my career, it was like, okay, well, I can, you know, knowing technique is great, but that's sort of like the springboard to jump into doing things in a different way or in my own way and all of that. I don't know if that answers your question.
what you're talking about there is kind of like you have to know the rules before you can break the rules. Then you know how to break the rules. I also responded to the formal aspect of school because I liked knowing the rules. And I felt like if you know the rules, then you can play the game. Mm-hmm. And if you then gain a lot of experience playing the game according to the rules, then you can be good at the game. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time to not be a sort of paint-by-numbers photographer. You know, like the light goes here, you do this, this is the exposure you're looking for, these are the numbers you want, and to become more interpretive. But that's something I picked up from you even while we were back in school. And, of course, it's something that we all picked up working for Bill. We're talking about photographer Bill Hendricks, who had a commercial studio at the time in Ventura, California, and who inspired countless people. So, yeah, I see what you mean for sure.
Also, I do a little bit of teaching. I taught when I first moved here to North Carolina, and then I've taught a few like seminars along the way. And one of the things that I try to tell my students and people that I mentor and stuff like that is that the technique of using your camera should be like muscle memory. It should be as familiar to you as reaching up and turning your turn signal on in the car, so that you don't, that you're not thinking about it. I don't think f-stops and shutter speeds when I'm holding the camera to my eye. I it's just automatic, and there are compositional things that are just automatic that are muscle memory. And so if those are so comfortable to me that they're not conscious thought, then my conscious thought can be concentrated on if I'm working on a portrait or if I'm working on a fashion shoot, then it's about my interaction with my subject and then looking for the decisive moment or looking for the light to be just exactly the way I want it, particularly if I'm shooting a live show. And so, you know, it's very hard because I remember the days when it wasn't like muscle memory, where I had to stop and think, okay, where's the exposure at? You know, and all of those things. But it's something that just happens after you put in 10,000 hours or so.
That's the magic number. I hear that a lot for golf and a lot of things, is the 10,000 hour right. mark.
Yeah, that's the Malcolm Gladwell thing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
After getting out of the military and after graduating Brooks, do you remember how long it took you to realize, or the job where you realized, holy shit, I'm doing it. I'm doing what I wanted to do, in that I'm traveling and doing the jobs that I want to do. I'm living the lifestyle that I had planned. Do you remember kind of when that was and what that job was?
I have a very, very distinct memory of plane flight. But what, you know, it was weird. Part of my story is so unique, and it's never happened. I've never heard any other photographer that had sort of like the meteoric change that I had overnight. So when I finished at Brooks, I thought, okay, I always do best by doing the things that I'm more uncomfortable with. So rather than moving back to Ventura and safely working in the studio that I had been working in while I was in school, I was like, no, I need to go find out what I'm really made of. So I moved to LA. I moved there, slept on some musician friend's couch. And I literally had $100 to my name when I got to LA. And I just started hitting the pavement as an assistant. And one of my mentors, who was, shout out to Jim Graysa, was an extraordinary graphic designer. Right before I graduated, he had kind of put me on the hot seat and said, what are you going to do, Steve? What kind of work do you want to do? And the only thing that I really could think of was that I wanted to work in music. I have always loved music. And you know, so I said, I'd love to work something in the music industry. He's like, well, who do you know that does that? And I thought, well, Lynn Goldsmith, she's a great live music photographer. I know she does that. He's like, oh, I know her. When do you want to meet her? It's like, really? So literally like 3 weeks later, I was standing on the front porch at her home in Los Angeles, knocking on the door to meet her. Now, I didn't end up working for her, but it sort of pushed me into a position of you go after the types of things that you want to do. I got this job, and there's lots of kind of freaky things that I can't explain, but one of the things that happened was that, you know, communities of assistants build up, and I had met this assistant, very nice guy. He called me up one day and he's like, Steve, I need you to bail me out tomorrow. I've got a gig and I can't do it because I've got an impacted molar. And I'm like, sure, what is it? And he's like, well, the gig is really cool. The photographer is kind of a jerk. No problem. I've worked with lots of jerk photographers. And I said, what is it? And he's like, well, it's a Michael Jackson music video. I was like, oh, okay. So I showed up and it happened to be the black or white video. And the guy was right. The photographer was pretty much a jerk. And he, but he liked me well enough that he said, come back tomorrow. And I kept going back and I ended up working for that fellow for about 3 years. And that included going with Michael to the Super Bowl. It included working on several music videos. It included going up to the, up to Neverland Ranch, and just sort of like, I became kind of his go-to assistant. And he called me up one day and he said, we're going to South America for the final leg of the Dangerous Tour. I want you to come with as my assistant. And so we got to go to South America and that was really cool. And then we came back and I had met this woman in Brazil and she'd sent a present to me, but she'd sent it to Michael's office. So they called me on the phone. Michael's office called me and they said, Steve, we need you to come in and pick this package up. I went in. They said, oh, by the way, we fired that photographer. So I assumed by that I was fired too. So I went around to everybody I knew in the office and shook hands and like, hey, it was great working with you and all that. And 2 weeks later, my telephone rings and it's Michael's vice president of communications. And he said, Steve, we were wondering if you would be interested in interviewing for the job of photographer. And I was like, okay. And I went in and I took a portfolio with me and it was an assistant's portfolio. You know, I had never photographed anybody famous. I had never, you know, I mean, my portraiture at that point was, I mean, if I look at it now, it's like, eesh. But what they knew was they knew that I had been setting up the lights. So I knew how Michael liked to be lit. And they took a chance on me. So overnight, I went from being the assistant to being Michael's photographer. And that happened. They said, we're going to send you to New York City. I'd never been to New York in my life. I had to produce a shoot with Michael in New York City. And I did okay. They liked the photos. The one thing when that shoot was going on, Michael was standing alone when we were taking a little break. So I went over to him and I said, Michael, thank you so much for this opportunity. And I said, you know, I wanted to tell you that when I was in the sixth grade, the whole year I sat next to a girl named Katrina Thompson. And the whole year she and I had an argument over who was cooler, the Jackson 5 or the Osmond Brothers. And I said, I just wanted you to know I had your back even then. And that was his reaction. He just thought that was the funniest thing. And when we finished the shoot, his people came in. They said, we have no idea what you said to him, but he likes you. And so if the pictures are good, you've got the gig. So about a month later, my phone rings and they said, hold on for Michael. And Michael was actually calling me at my apartment. And he said, Steve, tomorrow I need you to take the red eye to New York. And we're going to do a portrait session with myself and Lisa Marie in Trump Tower. and then we're going to leave the next morning, and we're going to go to Budapest, and we're doing a short film in Budapest. And Michael said, are you ready? I'm like, yeah, I'm ready. And so it was actually, I had been booked to be a second photographer with Neil Preston, who was a friend and mentor and somebody that I had been working with in LA on Woodstock 94. So I flew back from Budapest, went and met up with Neil. We drove up to Saugerties, New York, spent 5 days shooting Woodstock, came back, called Michael on the phone. He said, hey, stay in New York for another week. Stayed with him, stayed for another week, did another photo shoot with him. Flying back to Los Angeles, it was like, oh my God, that vision quest that I had when I was in Africa just came true a billion times more than I ever thought. I had no idea that it would ever be to that level. And it kind of blew me away, you know. And then, you know, I don't know if you'll get to this question or not, but I was, in a lot of ways, I was unprepared for what I was going to be doing as Michael's photographer. I was prepared to take the images. I was not prepared for the level of politics that I had to deal with. There were people within his organization that hated that I had gone, that I had had the route that I had taken, that thought with good reason that I was not qualified to be his photographer. And, you know, and there were things that were said, and that was really difficult for me. That was a part of it that I was not prepared for. But at the same time, I created some images that are, you know, and it was a very short period of time, but in that short period of time, I was able to create a couple of really iconic photographs of him and that I'm really proud of. So,
Chris, do you remember when you sort of realized, oh yeah, I'm doing it?
I don't have a specific job. I mean, I have a lot of specific jobs that I thought, well, this is a benchmark. This is a new level. This is cool. This is something different. I do remember, so I don't have the same photographic upbringing that you guys do, being trained in school. Mm-hmm. I learned kind of on my own, and then I learned a lot of what to do as well as what not to do as an assistant. Mm-hmm. I just went straight from being an assistant to starting to work and learning what to do and what not to do. And you know, there's always levels of, oh shit, I'm in a helicopter. Oh shit, I'm traveling. Holy crap, that's Carrie Underwood. Whatever. You know, it's always something that you kind of go, oh crap, this is new. This is awesome. I don't have a specific, do you? You have a?
I remember, yeah. It was after Brooks, and I had landed the job back in East Tennessee in Knoxville with a photographer, and a client that he had shot for before called with a job that was sort of a smallish job. And I think he thought it would be within my abilities to get my feet wet shooting for a big client where the images were definitely going to be seen. And yeah, I went to the hospital and I photographed these two doctors, just did a couple of portraits and had to use, you know, all the skills I had learned in school and everything I had picked up working at Bill's studio and rely on that muscle memory. And I just remember I tried a little, you know, rack focus technique, which is kind of a double exposure where, you know, it creates a certain look in the image. And that was something that they had never seen in an environmental portrait. And I just remember thinking, this is it. This is what I've been wanting to do. And I'm doing it now. It was like my first legit shoot. And it wasn't anything special, but it was momentous, you know, and very memorable. I can still picture exactly where I set up, what, you know, the Hasselblad medium format camera I was using, the Ektachrome film, the Polaroids I pulled, where the doctors were standing, I still see it very vividly. You know, it just kind of imprinted on me.
That's cool. Someday I'll make it.
Well, there's someday, that too.
After 30 years of being in the business, someday I'll have that moment where I go, hey, I made it.
I didn't say I made it. I said I'm doing it.
Right.
Right.
Well, and there's like a million other different moments that one can experience that, I mean, when you were talking about, when you said, you know, when you were in a helicopter, gosh, I remember, you know, my first experience in a helicopter was being medevaced when I was in the military. I had appendicitis and I had to get flown out to a carrier for surgery. That was fun. But I got to, when I lived in LA, I got to go up with the local rock crazy morning show with their traffic copter guy and cover LA traffic 2 days. And that was a blast. It was so much fun. And the pictures, it was a Marine layer, which Mark would know about that. I don't know if you ever experienced a Marine layer.
I don't know what that is.
The fog rolls in off the ocean and it usually burns off by 11, 12. And sometimes it's so low they can't fly, but it was just kind of like crap light. So it wasn't really, there wasn't any great images to be had, but still it was like, I'm flying in a helicopter. How cool is that? You know,
my first, maybe my only helicopter job was for a hospital. Mm-hmm. And it was in Knoxville, and they had new paint jobs on their two medical helicopters. So they flew us up to the Smoky Mountains, and they wanted shots from one helicopter to the other in the fall heading up to the mountains. Then they dropped me off on top of a bald in the mountain in the Smokies and flew both of them at me and kind of peeled off. Nice. So I was standing on top of a mountain with these two helicopters low passing over me.
Uh-huh.
And then they landed and I got back on and flew back to the hospital.
How cool.
It was awesome.
You know, I was just thinking that when you got that opportunity, I'm sure you're just, it's all you can, you just feel like you're holding on for dear life and you're trying to do what the previous photographer had done. Mm-hmm. And there's not much room for your own interpretation of things yet. Because it's a bucking bronco of a ride. And it's all you can do just to hold on. You're going to New York for the first time. You're doing a photo shoot with Michael and Elvis Presley's daughter. And you're the guy that's producing it. And you just want to get that right. At some point, you start to realize, okay, this is how it was done, but I'd kind of like to do it differently, right? I'd like to do this now, or I would like to do this. And you have your own ideas and your own way of exploring and figuring out how to create something new and original.
I would really love to say that I got to that point. I don't know that I did. In a lot of ways, you know, probably I don't have regrets, but it's like, I do wish that I could have pushed for more, but it was like a machine. There were camps, and there was this camp that was pushing it to be this way. And there was this camp that was pushing it to be that way. And like the biggest part of what I did. So I did what Michael was recording the history album when I started working for him. So it was like, go to New York, do portraits of him. And there was utterly no direction. There was no kind of, this is the look. The one thing that they did say was that he was sort of stepping away from like the military looking stuff. The first shoot I did with him, a friend of mine loaned me this antique South American military jacket with gold epaulets and stuff like that on the shoulders. And I did a couple of shots of him with that. It was really hard to get any sense of direction of even who I was supposed to be listening to. So I could bullshit you and say, oh, well, it happened at this point and I did this. And then after we finished in New York, after he finished recording the record, then it moved immediately into doing the music videos. And that part of it, it was like I was just there on set, and my job was to see what was going on, interpret what was going on, and make good images of that.
Like a documentarian,
exactly.
Just to record what was happening.
Exactly. The one thing that happened that was probably, it was a creative collaboration. So one day while we were in New York, Michael calls me on the phone and he said, come on over to the apartment. I want to talk to you. And I walked over there and he said, Steve, do you know the song Smile? And I said, I think so. And he said, well, here, let me sing it for you. And he, sitting as far away as Chris is from me, he sang a cappella the classic song Smile. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences that I ever had. And I mean, while he's singing it and his voice has just got this amazing purity, he didn't warmed up or anything, but it's just extraordinary. I said, yeah, I know that song, Michael. And he said, well, do you know who wrote it? And I said, well, not really. And he said, the music was written by Charlie Chaplin. I said, oh, wow, I had no idea. And so then for the next hour or so, Michael proceeded to tell me about Charlie, and he told me about the film The Kid and the young child actor who was in The Kid was a young man named Jackie Coogan, and Jackie Coogan was one of the first child stars, and his parents, his mother and stepfather, had absconded with his money. And so because of Jackie Coogan, the state of California did child labor laws and made it so that child actors had to have their money put into a trust. And so he's like, I owe a great debt of gratitude to Jackie Coogan, because when I became of age, the money that I had earned as a kid was there for me and all of that. So then he goes over to the bookshelf and he pulls this book out and he's like, this is a picture from the film The Kid. What I want you to do is, I've recorded the song Smile. It's going to be a single on the record. I want you to shoot the single cover. We want to take this picture and we want to emulate it. We want you to cast a child. We want you to have a set built and all of that. And that was the thing that I had put the most of myself into as far as, you know, producing it and bringing together all of the elements, but it still was emulating this classic image that was from this film, you know, this film. So, but other than that, I never got to really, I mean, and now knowing with the amount of creativity that I have now, it's like, oh my gosh, if I could only go back now and do that. But it's like, that just is a thing that happened to me, and it happened in the order that it did. And I can't really regret it, because, you know, it's a very strange thing. On one hand, a lot of people look at that and it's like, that's the main thing about Steve. But it's like, well, that was 2 years out of my career. And it was the first 2 years of my career, the first 2 years of my shooting career. And there are a million things that I've done since then. None of them as high profile, but all of them as that are more important to my heart. Than that one
thing. And probably even more creative, more yours.
Exactly, exactly.
There's no way you're going to be able to walk into a machine like that and sort of have your way, right, and rebuild the machine. You know, that's like a machine that's existing long before you got there. And when you leave, it'll be essentially the same when you leave. And
I think that's part of why they gave me the gig, was that they just sort of wanted, they wanted, you know, to continue on with business as usual. And I didn't have the wherewithal to be able to push back and say, well, no, it should be like this. It was just like, okay, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. Cause I didn't feel like there's a lot of talk about people that, you know, that feel like a fraud. I kind of was really, really aware of how green I was. And it was like, okay, well, I'm going to just kind of go into this. And like, one of the things that I knew was that it was temporary. I didn't think that this was my gig for the rest of my life. And so it's like, you know, I've gotten a lot of wisdom over studying Buddhism. And one of the things that if you study Buddhism, there's, you know, everything in life is temporary. You know, this moment, this time with these three people, this is the only time that it will happen exactly like this. And so it's like, okay, well, let's celebrate this moment and be in this moment. And I think that was what helped me to just sort of see it for what it was and not like cling to it like it was the end all and be all of my career.
Dang, I need to read up on Buddhism because I like that.
How can I get more of that?
Well, it's interesting because what we do is we capture moments, we freeze moments. And it's sort of a chicken or egg situation, but it's like, is the fact that I freeze moments, is that what helps me to like know that each moment that I'm living in is, you know, it's temporary? Or is it because I've studied that it helps me to know that, you know?
Well, it's interesting too, that if you think of it like that, I don't know about you two, but I can look at most or certainly almost all of my images and remember the circumstances around that shoot, especially the images that mean something to me, right? I can remember details like that story about my first gig. So it's because we're in the moment and present that we're able to capture them. And that almost heightens the experience because we're so present and we're so able to freeze it that years later we can go back and recall those feelings so purely, almost like we're there again. Whereas if you aren't present and you miss the opportunity to record it and you miss all of the future opportunities to relive it. It is a little bit like the chicken and the egg, but I think it starts with a photographer's attention to detail and appreciation of what's in front of them. You know, and I know all three of us have that appreciation and because we love what we do.
You know, we were getting back, we were talking about the technical stuff in the beginning and it's like, there's a certain point that I get to that. It's like, okay, I know that my equipment is good and it's functioning. And I know that I have the muscle memory to do that. So really all I have to do is sort of, and what I believe about creativity, I'm not a particularly religious person, but I think that there's some energy that I cannot explain. If I'm forced to put a name on it or spell it, there's a three letter word that works fine, you know, but my job is to tap into that. My job is to get my ego out of the way and let that flow through me and then press the shutter at the right time, you know, and it doesn't have to be complicated. It's just sort of like, okay, it's going to flow through me. I can trust that. I can trust that I have the muscle memory to have the technical part of it right. And then all I have to do is just sort of like be present in that moment and pay attention to what's going on. And when I'm paying attention to what's going on through the viewfinder and through the shutter, I'm not really thinking about me. It's so completely not about me. And I don't really think that I'm particularly gifted. I think that I'm only gifted in that I have taught myself how to get rid of all the other bullshit, to step out of my ego, to be present in the moment. But that's available to everyone.
I was just going to say, how do you summon that?
The muscle memory of having done it, I don't even know how many times. One of the measurements that I have in my Zenfolio account, there are over 400,000 images, and that's just stuff through the digital era. So it's like 400,000 times I've gotten the hell out of the way and pressed the shutter at the right time.
I think a lot of it when you're working, if you can put aside everything and just kind of concentrate on what you're doing, a lot of it is you see it coming and you can grab it it's kind of like shooting a sunset in really fast motion. It's like, it's getting better. It's getting better. It's getting better. It's no good.
Right.
You just have to know when that peak is. Right. And a lot of times if you're completely right brained and your left brain is doing its thing, aperture, shutter speed, angles and things, you can just react to, this is it, shoot it. This is it, shoot it. Mm-hmm. And the next thing you know, 2 hours have gone by mm-hmm. and you're exhausted mm-hmm. and you don't know why. Because you just forgot to pay attention and you just forgot to your ankle's sore, but you don't know it.
Right. Well, and it's about a balance. I mean, and that's, I think what I love about it is that you do have to be present enough to make sure that you've got a card in your camera and things like that, and that the battery is charged and that the power is on and things like that. So it's like, you can't completely divorce yourself from certain technical things. But at the same time, if you do that enough times that it's muscle memory, then you just kind of go, ah, now I can. And like the moments, what you're talking about, I've done a lot of work with dancers over the years and I love photographing dance. And there's something about just the fluidity of it that's just extraordinary. I really, really love it. And it's a blast to do. So
I'm sure dance and capturing that moment is the same thing as it's, you know, when sort of the peak is, and if you can time it right, you can just capture just the right moment. And then it's getting better, better, better. And then it's no good. And you have to wait till the next time around.
Right. And also, if it's, you know, if you do it after it's no good, then it's like, that's okay too. Cause I mean, one of the things that I try to stress to students and people that I mentor is that you have to fail. You have to look at that image that was almost there. And it's like, oh, shit.
And so close.
I think, was it in your first podcast that you guys talked about that?
We've talked about failure a couple of times, I think.
I mean, I don't think you can talk about creativity and pushing yourself without talking about failure, because you can't do those things if you, in the absence of fail. I mean, failure is in many ways your greatest teacher. Mm-hmm. Dance is interesting because it's the movement that is so compelling when you're watching it. And to think that you're going to take this movement and break it up into segments, you might just see one picture and you miss everything that happened before that moment and you miss everything that happened after that moment. But if you get that one moment just right, everything that happened before it and everything that came after it is somehow contained in that one photo. And which is why that one photo is so important, and everything before it and everything after it as a single image just isn't as good, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, and actually working with choreographers has helped me to see that. Cause I remember sitting with a choreographer that I've worked with quite a bit up in Detroit and looking at image after image after image, and they're like, no. And it took me, you know, it was another part of my training and my education. Like, okay, what is she seeing? What is she looking at? That extra element. And I am so deeply grateful for all of the creative people in all different fields that I've worked with, because really it's, you know, we are each other's teachers, you know, and you can, you know, sit and compare notes and like, oh, you do this. Oh, that's interesting. I do that. You know, I think that's what's great about this podcast. I'm glad that you guys aren't just only talking to visual artists, that you're talking to artists of all and creatives of all types. I think that's really an important thing.
I've just been thinking back about what you said and about the importance of getting yourself out of the way so that you can see what's in front of you and really tune in and concentrate on that person or that scene, so you can be aware of it, because it's trying to give you something. It's trying to do something, and it's counting on you to do your part. It's like the greatest collaboration.
And it's funny because there is always a part of me there. The whole entire secret of my success is that if I can erase everything from me that is false, everything that's a facade, everything that's bullshit, and present my authentic self to whomever or whatever I'm photographing, then they are free to reflect back to me their authentic self. And that's the secret of my success, you know? And it's weird because the one thing that did, you know, when in the time that I worked with Michael a couple of times, he's like, Steve, I just feel so comfortable in front of the camera with you there. And I don't want myself to be a performance artist. I want to present who I authentically am. And there's a very selfish reason for that. The selfish reason is that if I have to have multiple selves, the self that I present when I'm making photos and the self that I present when I am interacting with friends and the self that I'm presenting when I'm doing this and doing that, that's just way too damn complicated for me to try to remember it all. So it's much easier if who I am here is the same person that I am when I'm in the grocery store and the same person that I am in all of the different things that I do. It's just a hell of a lot easier for me to remember that.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and that is you said that you feel like you learn the most, perform the best, respond in the most positive way. That's not exactly how you said it, but when you face the things that challenge you the most, when you put yourself in an uncomfortable situation or you attempt to do something that's way outside your comfort zone, does that help you with your creativity? How does that stimulate you, or how does that work so much in your favor?
For me, it's just something that's always been, I can't say that it's always been. When I was 22 years old, I got clean and sober, quit drinking, quit using drugs. And part of that process was looking at myself deeply. One of the things that I looked at was fear. And I realized that I had been held back by fear, and that fear was just a huge, huge thing in my life. So it's like, okay, rather than do battle with fear, I'm going to embrace it. And when I discover the things I'm afraid of, I'm going to push myself to do it. The very first time after I got clean and sober, it was this man that was, he had been a investigative reporter for the Detroit Free Press. And he was just a really kind of intimidating guy. And I was scared to death of him. But I forced myself to talk to him because we were from the same area of the country. I grew up in Michigan. And I pushed myself to talk to him. And he ended up becoming a friend and a mentor. I was like, wow, that worked really well. When I was in school, I realized that I was essentially a shy person. And I was like, okay, well, what is shyness? Shyness is fear of people. So I'm going to force myself to be a people photographer because I will have to get over that. And I still am essentially a shy person. If you put me like at a party or something like that, a friend of mine, a very close friend of mine, recently got married, and the hardest part was the reception because I'm just like, oh my God, I have to talk to people. But I know that when I push myself to interact with people, that because of the thing I was saying earlier about being authentic, it's like, well, I'm not trying to sell bullshit. I'm just being who I am. So I can do it. Going to East Africa when I got out of the Navy, it was like, oh God, I'm scared to death of doing this. Okay, so I have to do it.
Now I got to figure out what I'm scared of and go do it.
Well, I mean, you just take stuff on head on. I mean, and there are so many things that you want to do just naturally because you have that curiosity. I think we all have that curiosity. And you just say, okay, this is next. This is next. Okay, and I'm going to do that. I probably have been tired of my work. I never thought about it in those terms as looking at the thing that I'm not doing as because I'm afraid of it as the possible thing that could get me out of my rut, mm-hmm. right? But that's a really super interesting way to look at it. It'll be hard for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It'll be hard for a lot of people. to do that, but I think it would be good to do it.
I've never done a thing that I was afraid of and had it like kill me. You know what I mean? And my father was really super protective of me when I was a kid. He was like, oh, don't go to Detroit. You're going to, you know, it's dangerous there. Don't do this. Don't ride your dirt bike by yourself. Don't do these things. And of course he never understood reverse psychology because everything he told me not to do, I did. But I even as early as like 10, 11 years old, I thought something is going to take me out. I don't want to spend my life looking over my shoulder for what might take me out. I want to look at everything straight ahead. I've got a lot of gray hair now and I've had an amazing life and I'm not owed another minute. I had a mentor once that used to always say, it's a seamless whole. The whole thing is all integrated. It's all, you can't say, well, this is my creative life over here. And this is my, you know, my personal, it's to me, there's no separation between all of it. And having a personal philosophical perspective is just the way that I have evolved in the way that I've chosen to go through life. But it's like, you know, right now, a lot of the work that I'm doing a lot of social justice work. And I really love that because it's very rewarding, not in any way monetarily, but it's very rewarding to my soul. And it's like, well, it's just an extension of the seamless whole of my life. That it's like, I want to be a contributing human being on this planet. And the way that I have, the tool that I have for being a contributing human being is my photography work.
So what is it that you do for personal work? We talk about personal work a lot and how important it is in the process and learning and kind of stretching and working out. What do you like to do for personal work where it's completely driven by you?
I love to photograph nature and I'm not really very good at it, but I just get great joy out of it. But I like photographing anything and everything. During COVID, we had a visitor, a red-shouldered hawk, that decided that it liked this hole in my yard that's literally 15 feet from my back door. And I've shot hundreds of images of that hawk and they're just boring pictures of a hawk sitting on a thing. But, you know, but it has brought me great joy. That made me decide, oh, I should buy a bird feeder. And I bought a bird feeder and I've been photographing birds in my backyard. And it's just, nobody cares. It's not work that anybody is going to see. It's not stuff that's going to be published. Like I only have myself for the client and it's like, oh, that's fun. I enjoy that. Earlier this year or early in, I guess in August of last year, some friends of mine had said that they were moving from South Carolina to Arizona. And I said, do you need somebody to drive a truck for you? And so I drove down to South Carolina, help them load up this giant ass U-Haul and drove it out to Arizona and then rented a car and drove back. And I had one really selfish purpose. In the middle of Oklahoma is a tall grass prairie preserve where they have an enormous herd of bison. And I wanted to go there and be there at the right time with the right light to photograph these bison. And I did. I actually got there in time to get sunset shots and then got up before dawn the next morning, was out there for early morning shots. And it made it was my reward for that whole trip.
It's important doing things completely for yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, that if everything you do, I mean, a lot of people turn photography, go from a hobby to a profession. And in making that transition, you end up kind of sacrificing the original reason why you got into it, because it just gives you pleasure.
Right.
And then when you find the hawk in your backyard, you kind of rekindle some of that and it's good for you.
Yeah.
Especially after the 30-year career.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I'm motivated by by joy. And I seek out joy in almost every type of photography that I do. I mean, I have three different websites. I have a fashion website, I have a architecture website, and I have kind of a entertainment website. I should probably do a politics and activism website because I've got tens of thousands of those images that are sort of languishing and all of that. I get joy out of doing all of those things. I get joy when I get, like a couple weeks ago, I spent a week doing corporate headshots and it was a blast. It was hard work, but it was a blast. But when I get to go out into nature, I mean, I was just in Knoxville visiting my mom. And on the way back, I left super early. I left before dawn and drove through the park because you have to do that. And I was like, oh man, I need to see a bear. I haven't seen a bear in a long time. And lo and behold, there's a bear. And I got out my super long lens and I got one shot that I'm happy with. And I was like, well, that's fun.
We'll have all of your URLs and your links to your socials in our show notes.
Okay.
So I'll get those from you and we'll put them on the website. And that way people can go check out your fashion and your soon to be released social website, which you're going to build soon, right?
Yes.
And all of the other things you do, and they can follow you and watch all the things that you're doing and get a chance to enjoy your work.
Thanks. That would be great.
Before we let you go, we always ask our guests for one thing, and we also always say one thing that you're looking forward to. So, Steve, what's one thing that you're looking forward to?
I am very much looking forward to this project that I'm about to start with a blues singer in Florida, and I'm not at liberty to discuss the details of the project, but I'm very much looking forward to it.
That sounds great.
I can't wait to figure out what that is someday. How long do you think it'll be before we get to know what you're talking about?
Well, I'll probably tell you over dinner.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Even better. Well, mum's the word. Mark, what are you looking forward to?
Dinner.
Speaking of dinner.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say anyway.
Was it really?
I'm looking forward to dinner. Yeah. We got to clean this mess up and then we're all going to go get something to eat. What Excellent. Are you looking forward to?
Well, we are in North Carolina and we are on this road trip and I'm looking forward to swinging back by through Atlanta and visiting my old high school and college roommate on the way back out of town.
Cool.
As we head home, I'm looking forward to catching up with him. I haven't seen him in a long time.
Nice.
Steve, we can't thank you enough for being here with us today. And we also want to thank our sponsor, NOSI College of Art. Want to let everybody know that Creativity in Motion is produced by the team at Penumbra Entertainment. And if you have any questions, we would love to hear from you. Especially all of you who've found this show. It's remarkable to us. We look at the statistics and we look at all the different places where this show is being downloaded and listened to. We would love to hear from you, especially if you have any questions or comments for Chris or me. Please send us an email at creativity@penumbra-ent.com. That's creativity@penumbra-ent.com. As always, we hope you will join us on the next episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast. Until then, don't forget, sometimes your greatest creative effort can come by turning and facing your biggest fears.